Good morning.
Good morning.
I received the kindest, most beautiful email this week from Pastor Steve. And I don't think I have to tell you, I'm preaching to the choir, what an absolutely great person he is and a great minister. And I'm honored that he asked me to fill in for him a couple of weeks here, and that he's doing so well in his recovery. Listening to the beautiful organ and piano music, I was reminded of a story that was told to me when I was growing up. My grandfather was a hard shell Baptist minister. Now, if you know anything about the hard shells, they don't believe in music. They believe in a cappella, everything, right? So there was no instrument in their church. So anyway, the church eventually voted to bring a piano into the church, upon which time my grandfather resigned because he wasn't going to hear of it. So little town near where I grew up over in White County, Norris City, the story goes that one of the parishioners in the church met Granddad one Saturday morning. He had gone into town to trade on the street and said, "Well, Mr. O'Neill, we hear that you're going down to the Presbyterian church now. And they've got an organ in that church." And Granddad said, "Well, an organ in the Presbyterian church is one thing, but a piano in the house of God is another." So, one of the greatest memories I have is Granddad would sit outside in the yard during the summer, and he'd have his Bible in his hands and his little bench out there under a big old oak tree, and he'd be studying his sermons and reading the Bible to himself and preaching to himself. And us little kids, we'd scoot around behind him, you know, and listen to every word that he was doing. He was quite a dude. Well, and by the way, I don't want you folks to worry about these political campaigns right now. Someone told me back there in the back of the church when I came in that, well, who in the world can you believe anymore? They're all calling each other liars and everything else. Well, don't worry about that. My good friend, Congressman Ken Gray, told a story some years ago when he was first campaigning. He was over in Vienna walking down the street and come up to into one yard, and there's a little circle of boys sitting in the yard, and there was a dog in the middle of the circle. So he went up and he said to the boys, what are you boys doing out here? And one little boy said, well, we're telling lies. And the one that tells the biggest lie gets a dog. And the congressman said, well, you boys shouldn't be doing that. Don't you know it's wrong to tell a lie? Why, when I was your age, I never told a lie. And the little boy said, give him the dog. So, you know, don't worry about the politicians. They'll all settle down after a while. He had loved her with all the passion of his youth, with the tenderness and caring which seemed far beyond the ability of most men to love their wives. He looked forward to building a home, having children, working together, raising a family, coming home at the end of a hard day's work, family dinner, perhaps a quiet walk in the evening dusk, holding hands, going over the events of the day. He had known something of her past. While it was true that she'd had problems, he had an uncommon love for her, and marriage would end whatever hold the past had upon her. She bore him three children, two sons and a daughter. They were good kids, smart, playful, eager to learn. He loved them as any father would love his children. He longed to spend time with them, to teach them, and he did. And their mother, he continued to love as no man could ever love a woman. But there were problems. Gomer was not satisfied. She kept going back to her old life, the life before she had met Hosea. A life of harlotry, of prostitution, of sin. He had begged her, pleaded with her, humbled himself before her, had at times become angry with her, but all to no avail. He loved her with all his heart and soul. He would have given anything, his very life, to have that love returned. But every day, she would leave him. She would go down to the pagan temple of Baal and sell herself as a prostitute there. Finally, he had to give her up. A divorce decree was issued. She went to live at the temple. A slave. Prostitution was the only life that she knew. He continued to care for his family, and he continued to love Gomer. He couldn't give her up. Even though she mocked him, cursed him, ran after other lovers, his love remained patient, understanding, never ending. Time went on. And one day, Hosea is passing by the temple of Baal, and his ears catch a familiar sound. It's the sound of the auctioneer. The temple prostitutes, who have grown older now and are no longer of any value to the temple priest, are being auctioned off into slavery. And Hosea looks upon that auction block, and he sees his beloved Gomer, old before her time, worn out, crushed by a life of sin and disobedience. But in that moment, compassion flooded his heart. Love compelled him to act. She may have been worthless to the world. She may have deserved his scorn and hatred, but to him, she was worthy of his love. He took all that he had, and he purchased her off of that auction block. He saved her from a life in slavery. He redeemed her from a life of being used to a life of usefulness. Why? Because he loved her. And because he loved her, he could forgive her. You will recognize the story of Hosea and Gomer as one of the greatest stories of forgiveness and love ever written. You will also recognize this story as the story of God and his relationship to the nation of Israel, his chosen people, who time after time would leave him to run after the false idols. And time after time, they would experience the forgiveness of his great love. What is America's relationship with God today? After returning time and again to chase after false gods, are we in danger of being sold into slavery? Will God have to purchase us from the auction block one day? There is another young woman. History does not record her name. The Lord is teaching in the courtyard of the temple, and suddenly thrust at his feet as a person who has been caught in the very act of adultery. The men who brought her there, the scribes and the Pharisees, filled with their own sense of self-righteousness, are spewing out their accusations against her. Listen to how the great minister Peter Marshall describes this scene. She lies before Christ in a huddled heap, trembling in her shame, shivering as she listens to the indictments presented against her. Tears stream down her face. Christ looks down at her, and perhaps there is an infinite sadness in his eyes. He turns his gaze from her to the circle of men who now stand before him. He sees the hard faces that have no pity, no mercy. He sees the smug looks of self-righteousness upon their face. He sees the clutching fingers that hold the stones with which they intend to put her to death. They are ready, her self-appointed judges, to throw them at this poor, defenseless woman. For it is the law, the sacred law of Moses, that such as her shall be stoned to death. They have already tried her in their hearts. But now, in an effort to trap Christ, they bring her to him to pass judgment upon her. If he chooses to repudiate the Mosaic law, the priest can accuse him of being no prophet. He had said that he came to fulfill the law, not to destroy it. If he permits the woman stoning, if he condemns her, he will lose his popularity with the multitudes who love and follow after him. Be ye therefore merciful, he had told them, as your Father in heaven is merciful to you. How then can he condemn her and still be merciful? He does not speak. Stooping down, he begins to write in the dust at his feet. We do not know what he wrote. Perhaps he looked up at one hard face after another, and with eyes that reach into the very depths of their soul, he began to write their sins in the dust. Liar, thief, adulterer, murderer, gossiper, drunkard. His gaze is steady. He speaks to them. He that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. And one by one, the stones drop to the ground. One by one, the men leave. They have cried for judgment, and now judgment has descended upon them. Now the two of them are alone. The stillness is broken by the sound of his voice. Woman, where are your accusers? Have none condemned you? And she answered him, no man, Lord, no man. And Christ, seeing her sorrow, seeing the contrition in her heart, says to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. No, we don't know her name. We don't know where she lived, nor who she was. But one thing we know, she was never the same again. She has looked into the eyes of Christ, and she has seen the great God of forgiveness in his eyes. She has been accused, convicted, judged, but not condemned. She has been forgiven. That God is willing to forgive sinners like you and me for Christ's sake is the most wonderful miracle of creation. For we are all sinners, guilty of different kinds of sin, no doubt. For there are sins of the heart, and sins of the mind, and sins of the disposition, as well as sins of the body. But he forgives. And his only condition is that we forgive one another. The Holy Scripture states emphatically, therefore, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. Whatever he or she may have done, no matter how wrong they may have been, or how innocent you were, we must forgive.